Illinois faces some big challenges. Today, you're about to hear a truly honest analysis of the problems we face. Equally important, you'll also hear an in-depth discussion of some practical solutions. This is your radio source for stories, insight, and the answers you won't hear anywhere else. Not in the media, and not coming from Springfield. You're listening to Illinois Rising, presented by the Illinois Policy Institute. Now, here's your host, Dan Proft.
Welcome to this edition of Illinois Rising. Dan Proft and my co-host this week is Austin Berg, writer with the Illinois Policy Institute, illinoispolicy.org. You can catch my act Monday to Friday, 5 to 9 a.m., Chicago's Morning Answer with Amy Jacobson. And Austin, big news this week on the front with the contract impasse between Governor Rauner and the state's largest public sector union, AFSCME, representing some 37,000 state workers. Labor Relations Board at the state level ruled unanimously that there is, in fact, a labor impasse, and that is a meaningful decision because it provides the opportunity for Governor Rauner to reassert the last best final offer he has given to AFSCME and to say, take it or leave it. This while AFSCME can pursue an appeal of the Labor Relations Board. Your assessment of how this plays out and how it should play out?
Well, I think it's easy for people's eyes to glaze over in this Minotaur's labyrinth of appeals and hearings and different boards appointed by different people and different asks coming from different sides. But I think the main point is that if Rauner is able to implement this contract, as this board basically says he could, that would be, I'm interested to hear what you would think, maybe the biggest taxpayer victory in Illinois in 20 years?
It would be
25 years?
I mean, you know, according to the number crunchers from the governor's office, $3 billion is what's on the table, but the $3 billion of difference between the wage freeze and other component parts that Rauner has offered in his last best final.
And not just the dollar amount, but symbolically, you have a government employee union that has been protected from all effects of a normal economy over the last 10 years. Their salaries have grown five times faster than the average private sector worker in Illinois. Just showing that union that they need to be accountable just like everybody else, I think, is huge.
And the other argument that Rauner has in his quiver to fire at his desire is the fact that everybody else includes 18 or 19 other collective bargaining units, smaller groups of state workers who've all accepted a wage freeze. AFSCME wants to be treated differently because they're the big dog on the block and they think they can exact 15 to 29% wage increases over the life of the contract from the governor. And so far, that is not the case. Now the governor in the driver's seat a bit. Well, so for more on this, let's turn to an expert in the space. She is a labor attorney, a labor policy expert with the Illinois Policy Institute. She is Miley Smith, who joins us now. Miley, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So just kind of lay out, per the Labor Relations Board's decision, what the governor can do and the time frame in which he can do it. You know, is he kind of up against the clock to make a decision here in the wake of that state board decision?
Right. Well, with this unanimous decision of the labor board, the board has now declared that there is an impasse. We are awaiting a written decision, and so everyone's a little bit in limbo while we wait for that written decision. But once there is that decision, the governor can implement his last offer, his last best offer, and then AFSCME has a decision. AFSCME can go along with that last best offer. They can accept those terms and stay at work. Or AFSCME leadership can reject that and go on strike.
One thing to just interrupt. The AFSCME posture of, you know, get back to the negotiating table. I had Krista McQuarrie on my morning show this week talking about this very issue and the kind of rhetorical position AFSCME's taken. And she provided some data points I did not know, that there have been 67 negotiating sessions between the governor and AFSCME in the last 16, 18 months, where there have been 300 proposals and counterproposals batted back and forth between the two sides. So the idea that, if we just go back to the negotiating table, then magically we're going to come to some sort of compromise agreement.
I think we need a couple hundred more proposals to finally get a good one.
The numbers and the time that has been spent on this to date, staggering.
It is. And the idea that something will be accomplished at the negotiating table is preposterous. Even the ALJ, in her earlier recommendations to the board, the ALJ recognized that some of the union's conduct, and this is a quote from her, called into question the union's commitment to reaching an agreement through bargaining. And then she mentioned at another point that actions of the union were inconsistent with a mindset of good faith bargaining. So we have, almost 2 years of bargaining, and this is the longest negotiations that have ever happened between the state and AFSCME. We're still not anywhere close to an agreement. And so the idea that, let's go back to the bargaining table, let's forget all of this that has happened between us, we can come to an agreement, that's a preposterous position by the union.
And I heard, Miley, is it true? So I heard on Wednesday that Rauner was attempting to implement the overtime rule after 40 hours of a work week instead of 37 and a half, and also trying to implement giving these $1,000 bonuses for everybody who's been to work for more than 95% of the work days in the last year. And now,
right,
Thursday, you have AFSCME going on these informational pickets after just... Does that make them seem out of touch? That they're going out, not working, handing out pamphlets, doing whatever, making speeches, when ostensibly the governor just gave them $1,000 bonuses, and now they have to work 40 hours a week before getting overtime like everybody else.
Right. It certainly doesn't seem like the best public relations move to those of us who are in the private sector watching this going on. You're right. One of the things that he has wanted to implement all along is a 40-hour work week. Those of us in the private sector look at that and think, yeah, that's the market norm. That's what is typical for someone who isn't a salaried worker, a 40-hour work week before you get overtime. And I think it's significant to add that just that provision alone, changing from 37 and a half hours in a week to 40-hour work weeks before there's overtime, just that alone will save the state $63 million over the terms of the contract.
And so with respect to the larger issue, he can implement his last best final, and AFSCME can appeal the State Labor Relations Board's decision. So how does this, is there a kind of a race on right now between implementation and getting and a court of appeals to stay the Labor Relations Board or overturn the Labor Relations Board's decision and force them back to the table? Tell us how this plays out legally.
Sure. Well, what would typically happen in litigation, maybe not necessarily in this case, because I keep saying this, we are in a different position with an impasse in the state than we've ever been in. We've never been in this position with the state and AFSCME. Basically because we've always had governors who've kowtowed to AFSCME's demands and just caved. So we're at a new position. We've never seen this happen or how this juggles out. But typically what would happen in litigation is the party that is the loser is going to ask the court to stay or to just put on hold that lower court or that agency decision. And so what I would expect AFSCME to do is ask a court, the court that they run to, please put on hold the implementation of this contract until we get through the appeal.
And if the court refuses, or if Rauner is a substantial way down the road in implementation of the last best final offer he's presented, then it's still frozen at that point, whatever point he's at in implementation, or how does that play out?
Yeah, well, that I would say that just really remains to be seen. If he has advanced fairly along in his implementation, I mean, it's really going to come down to what that panel of judges thinks. And so, we're in new territory. I think it's kind of exciting from my perspective to watch all of this play out, but it's new territory.
One of the 10,000 different ways this could play out, Miley, is that AFSCME ends up going on strike. They don't like this last final offer. And I think there's a lot of fear-mongering going on amongst just rank-and-file government workers, being afraid of what could happen during that, as well as taxpayers who... think that everything, the world's going to come to a halt should AFSCME strike. Could you lay out, just give a picture for people what a strike would mean for an everyday government worker, an everyday taxpayer in Illinois?
Sure, yeah. There are a number of moving parts here, so let's just talk about the taxpayers first of all. State operations are going to continue. What the state can do, first of all, I know the state has already, they've mentioned this before, the state has already started creating contingency plans within their the state agencies. So we know that there is planning going on, as to what to do if AFSCME workers walk out. So we know that there's some contingency planning going on. The state can hire workers. They can hire replacement workers. And so there is a possibility that new workers will be coming into the state and taking over some of these positions. So in terms of state operations, you know, we may see some bumps, but state operations are going to continue.
She is Miley Smith, labor attorney, labor policy expert at the Illinois Policy Institute. Miley, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dan Proff back with Austin Berg, writer at the Illinois Policy Institute, in this edition of Illinois Rising, and some below-the-fold election results at the state level here in Illinois from the November 8th election. Madison County voters down in southern Illinois, metro east area, just outside of St. Louis, Madison County voters passed a referendum capping the amount the county, not just the county, but nonetheless, the county controls what the county can do, can pass a referendum on election day, capping the amount the county can collect in property taxes, capping the amount the county can collect at 0.2% of a property's value. Maybe this is an idea that could be scaled under the rubric of property tax reform in Illinois.
You would hope so, because you have all these local governments, and by the way, we have the most units of government in the country by far. These government bodies every year eke up their levy just a little bit, just under the cap. No approval from voters, no discussion. Let's just get what we can get, and that leads to, in places like Madison County.
Yeah.
If only he was there, maybe their tax burden would be lower.
If only we was limited to there.
So we had. In Madison County, their property tax burden is up 40% over the last 10 years. That's the property tax bill as a percentage of their income. It's now about $2,300 a household there in Madison County, which is by no means an extremely prosperous place. That's falling mostly on middle-class taxpayers. And that story is repeated throughout the state, where you have people with property tax bills that are larger than their mortgage.
One other idea in this category of property tax reform, and considering Illinois has the highest property taxes in the nation, kind of a salient topic, is something Colorado did some 20 years ago, which is to amend the state constitution to prohibit state and local government from raising taxes without voter approval, also prohibiting state and local governments from spending revenues collected under existing tax rates without voter approval if revenues grow faster than the rate of inflation plus population growth. It's the old taxpayer bill of rights that was popular in small C conservative policy circles in the 90s and kind of disappeared. And perhaps it's time it reappears in the land of Lincoln. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by Rob Nadelson. He is a law professor, 25 years, worked as a law professor at multiple universities, expert in constitutional law. He is also a policy wonk at a number of think tanks, including the Heartland Institute here in Arlington Heights, Illinois, as well as the Independence Institute in Colorado and the Montana Policy Institute in Bozeman, Montana. Rob, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate your time.
It's great to be with you.
So as we're wrestling with how to rein in spiraling property tax increases in Illinois, and we have some weeds growing through the pavement in parts of the state, what's the experience of Colorado with its taxpayer bill of rights that may be instructive for something that Illinois policymakers could consider?
In 1992, Colorado put into its constitution by voter initiative a comprehensive measure that limits taxes, spending, and debt. This, by the way, is not in any way unique. A number of states have these, and limits on taxes, spending, and debt have been in state constitutions really since before the 1840s. But they're not all equally effective, and over the years, Colorado's limits had eroded in various ways. So this measure was adopted in 1992, and its primary mechanism is to allow a vote of the people when taxes or spending or debt rise to a certain extent. It's been very controversial, as you would imagine. There are folks who have never been reconciled to it, who wage guerrilla warfare and sometimes open warfare against it constantly. But there's no question, in my mind anyway, having looked at the evidence, that Colorado has benefited enormously from it. We were in a very deep recession at the time it was adopted. We shortly came out of that, and we've been one of the fastest growing states economically ever since.
So, Nate, we have the we have this guy, this Irish Catholic guy in Illinois who doesn't much care for voter-initiated ballot referendums. What are the odds of people being able to compel their lawmakers directly to sort of institute this type of thing down the line?
The kind of restriction we're talking about is called a tax and expenditure limitation, or TEL, T-E-L. And economists and other researchers have been studying them for years. And one of their conclusions is that the best ones are the ones that come from the voters. That if the legislature tries to craft its own resolution, even if it takes the form of a constitutional amendment, it usually looks like Swiss cheese because they give themselves so many outs. In fact, if it's not adopted by voter initiative, it may be worse than nothing. Because if they go ahead and they adopt something that looks like a limitation, but really isn't, then that gives them political cover for tax increases and spending increases that they wouldn't otherwise have.
To your point, didn't that sort of happen in Colorado, or am I misremembering? Didn't Bill Owens, Republican governor, didn't he water down the Tabor in Colorado during his tenure?
Yeah, to a certain extent. There is a better analogy, though, from Colorado. Colorado had a legislative limit, and they the legislature regularly came up against the limit, and then it would exceed the limit. And so, if anything, spending accelerated when the limit was created by the legislature. Now, Bill Owens was a big supporter of the Taxpayer Bill of Rights when it was passed, and for several years thereafter.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right, when he was governor, supported an initiative which critically weakened the expenditure part of the Taxpayer Bill of Rights. The part that requires votes on taxes is still largely, not entirely, in effect, but the expenditure limits have been weakened, and that was partly because a Republican governor changed his mind once he was in office.
And so this is really mission critical. You have to have kind of both sides of it, right? And the idea of, which is fairly rational, the idea of limiting expenditures to no more an increase year over year than population growth plus inflation seems a sensible indexing and that forces the political class to live within its means. And if you don't have that kind of hard line, then you're going to see what you're describing occur.
You know, that's right. I mean, the fact is the political class, as you put it, is very well organized. They're much better organized than most of the rest of us who are out there working for a living in our own businesses. And they think constantly about ways to increase taxes and spending. So you do need some kind of a constitutional restriction. There's another thing, too, which I think isn't really on a lot of people's radar screens, but is important. As an economy advances, the amount of the economy that you devote to any particular good or service should decline. We spend a lot less on food, for example, mm-hmm. We spend much less of our income on food than people had to spend, say, 200 years ago or 100 years ago. We spend less on clothes. We spend less on commodities. By the same measure, over time, the share that government takes from the economy should decline, not stay the same or increase, but decline. And in many states, the opposite is happening. That's not the evidence of a good economy, and it's not a harbinger of a good future.
And to your point about how it's benefited Colorado, the argument would be made in a state like Illinois, oh my gosh, you're going to starve K-12 education, for example, of resources. Nobody will ever learn to read or do simple math again in Illinois if you do this. What's been the experience in Colorado in terms of the quality of K-12 education?
Well, of course, the education a lobby complains, and I should clarify and say the public education, the government education lobby complains a lot But there's a lot of evidence out there indicating that above a certain level spent everywhere, there's no particular connection between the quality of schools and the amount spent. People say, well, why is that the case? And the answer is there are a whole lot of reasons, but that's the reality. And that reality has shown up in Colorado as well. Colorado test scores and other indications of educational quality have done just fine, even though, of course, the people who run the public schools claim they never have enough money. As a practical matter, what happens is, in all too many cases, when you do give them additional money, it goes to things like, diversity counselors and administrators rather than into the classroom where it belongs. So it generally speaking, in the private sector, we get our greatest productivity growth when things are tight. When the businesses don't have all the money they think they need and they have to make do, that's when they really make progress. And the thing is generally true in the public sector as well. You have to keep a fairly tight leash if you want government to get better.
Yeah, excellent point. He is Professor Robert Nadelson, Senior Fellow in Constitutional Jurisprudence at the Heartland Institute here in Chicago Metro, the Independence Institute in Colorado, as well as the Montana Policy Institute. Professor, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Dan Proft back on this edition of Illinois Rising. My co-host, Austin Berg, writer, Illinois Policy Institute, illinoispolicy.org. Also, Hollywood could be beckoning. The writer credit on the Madigan documentary that's been so talked about over the last 60 days or so. Before we get to the vote on speaker, your assessment of the Madigan documentary and how it was received, and of course of how your writing was received.
Well, I'm biased, but I'd like to say it was a smash hit, Dan. It was interesting to see
the Aaron Sorkin of the right. That's actually an insult. Now I'm gonna come up with better.
Our dialogue is
Paul
a little
Haggis
bit better
of the right. Yes,
but we'll have so. Look, I had a ton of radio and TV interviews for that documentary, and I think the most interesting thing that developed is you saw kind of a splintering between inside and outside media in Illinois. So everyone covered it. People would say this is a must-see if you're involved in Illinois politics, but then you'd have the guys who've been writing about this stuff for 40 years saying, yeah, I mean, there's nothing wrong in it, but there's nothing new. As if explaining a vast patronage web, a property tax scheme that he makes millions of dollars on, him drawing the map, him blocking, controlling the legislative process at every turn, that's just old news, nothing to see here. I've been seeing this stuff for 40 years, so it's not that big of a deal to me.
Well, it's telling, right? So what they're saying is they're inured to it.
Yeah.
And that's just the way it is. And so, the other thing that's funny about this too is they pretend that they're just scriveners. Yeah. They're just writing what's happening here. So yes, we've documented what's happened, but in point of fact, they're participants in what has happened and continues to happen.
If not active participants, then willing participants, and help reinforce that this is just status quo in Illinois, that the attorney general is the daughter of the speaker. That's whatever. And you really saw that in some of the news coverage. And then other news coverage was, wow, this is something everyone should see because not everyone has seen a portrait of the speaker put together in this way. And it is really shocking when you get an hour-long portrait of someone who's amassed this much power and you delve into that political culture, and it just happens to be that an outgrowth of that political culture is a media class that doesn't really want to deal with it, honestly. So I think we saw actually... In the elections, you saw a total rebuke of Madigan in a state where you had the Republican nominee get, less than 40% of the vote, in a state where you had Madigan draw the map himself. He lost 4 seats in the House.
Yeah, not in the suburbs, in suburban Cook County, though. And the problem is that's where 60% of the people live.
Right.
So you've got that ongoing challenge. Speaking of the challenge, though, and the seats that he lost, four in the House and two in the Senate, which kind of by extension are his because John Cullerton is just sort of one of his henchmen, even though he's the Senate president. The prospect that there may be some Democrats who are sufficiently chastened by the outcome of the November 8th election at the legislative level that they will take a pass on Madigan for that all-important speaker vote come January and the seating of the new House and Senate. You know, there's some, we've had candidates, Democrat candidates in the past say, oh, I'm going to vote against the speaker if I'm elected. Most of them were not elected, so we never had that chance.
Wonder why.
But even the idea of voting present or taking the additional step of voting against the speaker, even though he will retain his speakership, that's going to be a fait accompli. But any message senders in the Democrat caucus that would then signal again, maybe Madigan doesn't have the iron fist that he had prior to November 8th.
Yeah, no one's voted present on the speaker vote in 30 years. And when that happened, Martino was the rep, not the Martino we know today, his father. He was immediately stripped of his committee chairmanship. So Democrats know what happens if they go against him. The people who lost during the election, you have his House Assistant Majority Leader, John Bradley. He's voted for the speakership 6 times. Mike Smitty, he's voted for the speakership twice for Madigan. Clunan voted for Madigan twice. I think that this could easily become the toughest vote these people have to have in the 100th General Assembly for some of them.
But now the flip side is those people that are outgoing legislators that lost on November 8th also received 7 figures worth of support from Mike Madigan. So it wasn't like Mike Madigan didn't try to do everything he could to salvage them. There just was no salvaging them in these districts.
And I think that's part of the fear, right? And if you have people in districts going out seeing this movie or signing petitions on IllinoisPolicy.org to vote for someone else for speaker, I think there's a real fear that people see this guy's name as being toxic. And you have to go back to your district and explain why you voted for him for speaker. And I think that's something that voters should be conscious of. Why is the speaker vote important? Where does Madigan get his power? He's not like any of these other state reps. Why is that? These are very simple questions that I think people are starting to open their eyes to, and this vote will be the culmination of that come early January.
Dan Prof back with Austin Berg, writer for the Illinois Policy Institute, and some scholarship provided by the Illinois Policy Institute this week finds that Illinois' pension debt has jumped to $130 billion in unfunded liabilities in 2016. That's up from $111 billion in 2015. And you translate that down, that means every household in Illinois now owes more than $27,000 each in state pension debt. It's about a 17% increase 2016 over 2015. So things are getting worse.
Breaking news.
Great.
The pension crisis is getting worse.
I thought it would just take care of itself if we didn't do anything.
A quarter of every dollar now in Illinois' general revenue fund budget is going to pensions. And it's almost amazing that we talk about anything else in state government at this point. And it's because it's not the sexiest of topics. It's wonky and it's depressing when you have people not being able to get government services, people literally dying on waiting lists in order to get care in some cases, and yet you have this enormous chunk of the budget to go to pay for promises that should have never been made.
Well, let's see if we can sexy this up a bit with Ted Dabrowski, who's the Vice President of Policy at the Illinois Policy Institute and a handsome gentleman. Ted, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for the wonderful comment.
You're welcome. So you were in the back room with the green eye shades on doing this number crunching, and they let you out to explain it to us rubes out on the hustings here. So what does this mean other than just kind of more bad news and more numbers that are incomprehensible?
Yeah, it's just more bad news. $130 billion in debt, which means nothing to most people. It's just another big number with lots of zeros after it. But to make it more simple, we've seen that the debt that taxpayers are expected to bail out on pensions rise from just 7,000, you know, 10, 15 years ago to 27,000 per household. Basically, the pension systems are so bad that the government is going to come at some point and raise taxes and ask taxpayers to bail it out. And those who don't make much money won't have to pay more, but people who do have an income could expect to pay $25,000 to $100,000 over the next, you know, few years to bail the system out.
And one of the important points too that we would try and remember to restate in these conversations is with respect to public sector workers, who, as you find, now only have 38 cents on hand for every dollar they need to pay out future benefits. That's the status of state pension funds, generally speaking, is that we're on their side and they're not. The discussion about restructuring public sector pensions and at a date certain bending the cost curve by forging a new deal for benefits that have not yet been earned is about actually salvaging their pension so they don't get IOUs in the mail rather than their pension checks upon retirement. And it just seems like that is a message that we're having a very difficult time penetrating.
Well, you know, the sad thing is that these pension plans that were concocted long ago, you know, they don't work. They're unpredictable. They're uncertain. They're unfair for everybody. And it's for everybody, not just the taxpayers who have to bail it out. But, you know, if you're a worker, you've got all these promises made to you, and now you're finding out that the system's effectively bankrupt. And, you know, the politicians keep making promises that they'll somehow figure it out. But each year, things get worse and worse and worse. And the third group that loses out are the people who depend on government services. You know, they're watching all the funds for education and health care and roads. They're getting cut, and it's all for pensions. And so everybody's losing from this system. And the scary part is nobody in the political system is talking about making the big reforms that they can make right now, things that are allowable within the Constitution today.
Ted, as Dan, to use Dan's words, government workers are often, this is one of the big excuses for not moving over to something like a 401k plan, is that these workers are rubes and they can't manage this money. How could they manage to do that? Could you talk about what returns this pension fund has earned versus what me, Joe Schmo, would just do putting in the stock market over the last few years?
Well, you know, it's amazing. You know, we've all seen what's happened with the stock market since the Great Recession. It is just skyrocketed. We've seen massive returns, and if you just had your money in some basic account that follows the indexes, you're doing extremely well. Well, during that same period, the pension funds, which are for our police and our firefighters and our teachers and our workers, those pension funds are collapsing. They're getting worse. And so the government has proved, politicians have proved, that they can't manage money regardless of whether stock markets are doing well or not. They've done great in the last few years, and the public sector pensions are getting worse, while Joe Schmo, who's got a little bit of money in his 401k, is doing excellently.
Is that an over-investment in bitcoins, or is that just the fact that obligations are outpacing the ability to pay them even with great returns?
Right. So the problem with pensions is, first of all, they're missing all kinds of money from the system. The big majority of that is because the benefits are growing faster than taxpayers can ever keep up with it. It's like a moving bar. You know, every time taxpayers put in money, the benefits grow so fast that the hole is always there.
And you mentioned, Ted, I just want to get to this. You mentioned that there are some things that can be done within the constraints of the Constitution, so you can't use that as an excuse either. Give me a couple examples of things that could be done right now if there was the political will.
Right. So tomorrow we should have all new employees on 401k style plans, the same ones that, you know, the private sector is in, and the same ones that many university professors in Illinois have. They're the one group that's kind of been selected to have that kind of plan since 1998, and they're doing just fine. So we need 401ks for current new employees. And then for existing employees, those who don't like the game, those 32-year-old teachers who said, I don't want a pension, I don't believe in this thing, give them an option to have a 401k. And those two things right there can have a dramatic impact on you know, one what happens going forward in pensions, and two, it'll send a signal to the rest of the nation that we're finally moving towards fixing our problems.
All right. He is Ted Dabrowski, Vice President of Policy, Illinois Policy Institute. Ted, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dan Proff back with Austin Berg, writer for the Illinois Policy Institute, on this edition of Illinois Rising. And Austin, great news this week. The Chicago City Council passed a budget. And you know I know it's great news because Tiny Dancer said so, saying of this budget that was approved 48-0, you can say Chicago tomorrow is better because of the work you have done over the last 5 years, Rahm Emanuel told the assembled trained SEALs. A very touching moment. Alderman Ed Burke, the dean of the city council, if you will, said, I'm even seeing smiling smiles on the faces of my colleagues, which makes us feel very, very confident, not only that this is not only a good budget, but that it is looking very, very good for Chicago's future.
Sounds like Trump.
Very, very.
A lot of Aries. Good.
Tremendous. So things are tremendous in Chicago because all of these Chicago Democrat politicians got together and passed a budget.
And meanwhile, the average family is going to pay about $1,700 more a year in taxes than they did before Mayor Emanuel took office.
Can you really put a price, though, on a happy alderman? Smiles on the faces of Ed Burke and his colleagues. Isn't that what's important?
It's great.
So that's it. Now, I didn't hear anything about the Chicago police and fire pensions, which are under 30% funded and trending towards insolvency. I didn't hear anything about the state of public safety in Chicago that has more murders, raw numbers, than L.A. and New York combined in 2016. I didn't hear anything about the Chicago public school systems other than Chicago public school property taxes will increase by $245 million in 2017, with most of that money not going to the classroom, but to the Chicago Teachers Pension Fund. I did hear that. So that's what I heard. But so the quality of life in Chicago getting better as the result of all of these noblemen and magistrates coming together to agree on the way in which Chicago denizens will be fleeced?
Among aldermen, I think quality of life is as high as it's ever been.
I don't think so. And I would submit Exhibit A. They did not get face value World Series tickets.
Oh, good point. I forgot about that.
So, I mean, it's been a tough year for the Chicago aldermen, which is why it's nice to end it on a high note, you know, where they could come together.
This is like the World Series.
Celebratory.
So I think, obviously, we can talk to death about all the problems Chicago has. Even if Chicago was this gleaming metropolis, you would have a serious problem with the way that these budgets get passed year after year. So, for instance, this thing got passed on Wednesday with a contentious 48-0 vote.
Yeah.
Do you want to guess when the city released its analysis of the budget?
Why do we need an analysis? You've already said, Ron, this will make things better. I mean, what more do you need?
So the Council Office
of
Financial Analysis.
Are you not taking him at his word?
The Council Office of Financial Analysis, which is the city budget watchdog, released that analysis Wednesday, hours before the vote. The budget hearings that happened for weeks before, about half of aldermen attended those. 40 aldermen blew off the ethics hearing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is not, this is a serious, serious governance problem beyond any of the dollars and beyond any of the smiles that Ed Burke is seeing.
So what you're trying to tell me is that the 50 luminaries on the city council are not as fully engaged as they would otherwise have you believe?
Well, it's not you can barely call it a legislative body. If we have billions of dollars being spent unanimously without half of the people coming to the budget hearings, most of the budget hearings are either people congratulating city staffers or pestering them because they didn't get a pothole filled fast enough. These people aren't legislators. They are kings of their mini fiefdoms. They only care about those things. They could care less about what this budget spent and what it spent it on, as long as they get their piece of it, it seems.
I wonder if it'll be all smiles and all high fives when federal bankruptcy court appoints an emergency manager to govern Chicago for a time, like Detroit. That's a few years in the offing, but it's coming.